Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to another edition of the New Africa Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Bilal Masadiq Bynum, along with my co-host,
Abdul Aziz Shaheed. Assalamu alaikum. Greetings to you, Brother Bilal, and our audience. How are you today, brother?
Alaikum salam, Brother Aziz. I'm trying to get my volume up a little bit. I don't know what's happening with it. I'm barely getting any volume here, but we'll get it right here in just a moment.
Okay.
In the meantime, like I said, welcome to the show. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you pretty clear.
Okay, it's just that I'm not hearing you too well, but in the meantime, we have to go with what we got. I don't know why my volume is so low, but welcome to the show. And of course, this is our discussion tonight is the power of the black dollar in doing business in the black community and also in Africa. So that's going to be our discussion. Why don't you say something? Let me see how well I can hear you, Brother Aziz.
Okay, yes, the show tonight is building business in our communities and the black and African communities and the power of our dollar, which we know is powerful. You know, I was looking at the news this evening and it was showing the poverty we have in America, various cities and all of that, and it was showing... Well, actually, it was the evening news and how around Washington, D.C., in the majority of the parks in the city, there's encampments of homeless people with the tents, so forth and on. And they were showing tonight how there was a number of them started, the city started to evict them out of there to try to find other places. And they were actually showing these big rats, you know, that was running through the encampment where the people live and all the trash and all that. And as an American veteran who's been to war for this country, it really gets under my skin when I see this homelessness of so many Americans, African-American as well as Caucasian, but great deal of African-Americans. It really gets to me to know that we can send billions of dollars outside this country to help every damn body else except our own. We, as a people, it is a must that we protest this and show our displeasure by protesting in an orderly manner and not like those treasonous enemies to our government who tried to overthrow our government in January the 6th. You know, they were the same as the British who came and tried to conquer our country, and the British, inshallah, and hopefully we beat their butt, but the mentality still exists. And it gets under my skin like this. We want to do business. We're not going to be able to do business with one another as a people and save our money when so many of us out there in poverty and we're sending billions of dollars over to help somebody else fight a damn war. And we got a war here in America on poverty and a big war on ignorance. Some of the wealthiest people in this country, the most ignorant people in this country, because they don't have no compassion, no heart for people. And, you know, America, we've got to change this. We for the better. We're not talking about going against America, destroying anything or nothing like that. We're talking about making this country better. And the way we can make America better is for us to be doing business with our own selves. To show love, turn that dollar around here and put it back into our community where it should be. We have to do this. You know, a lot of our people don't want to do that. They don't want to stand up. It took a lot of people to march on the front line with Martin Luther King when they marched all those places. And knowing that a bullet could come from anywhere and strike them down. Martin Luther King was warned that he might be shot when he went to Memphis to give that speech, but what he was doing to help his people was bigger than him, and that's why he did what he did. And, you know, when we look at that and we say, wow, this brother gave his life for that like many other civil rights people gave their life. So it's not asking much of us to stand up just like we stood up, a lot stood up for the Black Lives Matter. We see these four black officers beat up our brother. And then our opponents, they say, why should we, Black Lives Matter, when it don't even matter to y'all? Look at what the police are doing to us. So we can't show no sympathy and all that there for these people that do this. Anyone who harms us, whether they're black, white, or whatever, they are an enemy to what we're trying to do. And what we're trying to do is build a better community. And there's no better way to do that than through business.
That's right.
Where I wanted to start off tonight, because I am upset at the way things are being handled. Like I say, money being sent out of this country, our brothers and sisters over in Africa being robbed blind. They have no weapons to protect themselves. At least we have something here to protect ourselves, as the Second Amendment says, the right to bear arms. So that's good. We can do that. We can't bear all the arms we want, because a lot of these so-called militias, they have been authorized to get weapons that the military don't use no more, like 50 caliber machine guns, 30 caliber machine guns. Said nobody have those to be using them on people in the public, let alone the wars that they were used on years ago. And all of us brothers that have been in wars, Vietnam, Korea, Desert Storm, all these things, that we know the travesty that comes when killing another people. As Brother Bilal and I discussed a few days ago when we were talking, it takes a lot out of an individual if you go to war and you actually know you killed another human being. You could never get rid of that feeling, you know, and it's a haunting feeling to kill someone else. So, you know, we've got to show more compassion for one another like we did when we were segregated and we knew we had to depend on one and help one another. We didn't see the cases of poverty, the brothers and sisters laying around in the streets becoming crackheads, dope addicts, and all. We didn't see that. And it's all because of the lack of economics in our community. So that's the way I'd like to start the program out, as far as me having something to say about what's going on in the country today and the direction that we should possibly be heading in terms of business in our community for the betterment of our community.
Well,
thank you, and I turn it over to you, my sister.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Aziz. Boy, you start off with a fire tonight. How you doing,
Thank
Brother
you.
Bilal? You start off with a fire tonight, and I'm so, so glad that you did. And that passion you're talking about with the black dollar, you know, it is so, so pertinent that is discussed and it's reiterated and rediscussed and constantly talked about on our programs, other programs, because we need to get it out. I am fortunate to have a guest on for my segment of this piece. I brought in a guest today, and she's a powerhouse when it comes to empowering black businesses to go to Africa and produce business in Africa and connect with businesses in Africa. And her name is Melissa Muhammad. And she is the CEO and the founder of Black and Global Business Network. When Sister Melissa gets on, Melissa, let me know when you're on. But in the meantime,
Assalamu alaikum.
You're on. All right, Brother Bilal, with your permission, is it okay if we move forward? Or
no, go right ahead, sister. It's an open mic. We look forward to our conversation.
Awesome, awesome. Well, let me tell you about this amazing sister and her organization. Black and Global Business Network is a international business development, consulting, training, and networking company. They help black-owned businesses access government resources to sell their products and services globally. The guest that we have today is Melissa Muhammad, who is an international success mentor to Black CEOs. Her history is an international tax attorney who specializes in helping international businesses operate worldwide. For over 20 years, she has traveled to numerous countries negotiating billion-dollar transactions and has trained tax officials in over 153 nations. Now she helps Black-owned businesses export globally and access government resources to turn concepts into contracts. Everyone listening, brothers and sisters, this woman is a powerhouse, and we're so, so appreciative that she has come to the show and is going to take part in this discussion about the Black dollar. Sister Melissa Muhammad, how are you doing today?
I'm well, by the grace of Allah. And again, I'm going to hire you to be my PR agent.
Really? Don't tell that to your people. Yeah. You have an awesome team. You have an awesome team. They say that, they're going to get me. They're going to get me. What I can say personally is that my business partner, Krasten and I, we've been working with Sister Melissa now for, and her organization now for a few months, and already we're seeing the progress and the productivity. We have some discussions in the work right now with your team for Morocco and Kenya, and that is awesome. That is awesome to get some contracts moving in over there. So, Ms. Muhammad, first and foremost, please, please tell us, how did you get into this industry, right? How did you get into this industry, and when did you realize the power of the Black dollar to where you needed to design and develop the organization Black and Global Business Network?
Sure. So thank you all for the invitation to speak to your audience tonight. It's always – this is – definitely something that is my passion. So I am an international tax attorney, and people say, what is that? And governments, I work for everybody's favorite government agency for over 20 years. That's the Internal Revenue Service, and that's my story. I'm sticking with it. Everybody loves to see people from the IRS. But most of the time, people don't know that when you see that the IRS will send people like me around the world in order to open doors or to increase or to facilitate trade and by working with other countries. So people who do the type of work that I do as an international tax attorney, we would work with tax agreements, trade agreements, and the more money that a company pays overseas, the less is coming back to the U.S. So there are a lot of programs that are in place between governments that facilitate that type of trade. And so the way I got there actually was quite interesting, because I am in the Nation of Islam, under the divine leadership of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And actually, when I was in law school, okay, I'm going to date myself a little bit right here. I was in law school around the Million Man March, and one of the tenets was to increase trade for the benefit of myself, my family, and my people. That was one of the tenets of the Million Man March pledge. And so I had always thought being an international attorney would be great, but I didn't know what that meant. It just sounded really, really great. And so I just went on a mission to really learn tax, because I wanted to protect us from the inside. And I knew that I had finished my law degree. I was practicing criminal defense. You know, I knew I wanted to do something different. And tax was the way that I felt that I could protect us from the inside. And so I decided to go back and get a second law degree. And I decided to go and work for the IRS. But when I was getting the second law degree, there was an area called international tax. Again, I didn't know what that was, but I decided to specialize in it simply because, you know, that was something that the minister had addressed in the Million Man March. And so when I got that second degree, and actually then the specialization was a third law degree. And so I got that, and then I said, okay, let me apply to the IRS. and to some other agencies so I could build my strength from the inside in order to build our defense. Because we know that when the government comes for different groups, that tax is one of the areas that they come in. So I wanted to be prepared for that. And so in preparing that, I ended up going to the IRS. Never in my life would I have ever imagined what my career turned into, because when I joined that international group coming to D.C., and then here's the interesting thing. I came to D.C. to interview for that position during the Millions More movement, which was in 2000. And when I told them I'm coming to D.C. for the Millions More movement, and they asked me, can you interview while you're here? So I'm very transparent about who I am and what, you know, what I do and my interests are. So, you know, in taking those steps, I joined their international division, and these people have literally sent me all over the world doing some quite incredible things, and I learned a tremendous amount about business, analyzing business, internal structures to business, how to move them around the globe. But, you know, my tragedy was, though I lived and worked as a diplomat in many different countries, I learned so much. I worked with tax officials in so many different nations. My tragedy was I had never seen a black-owned business. And that was in over 23 years, not one. Wow. I had never seen a black-owned business come to the U.S. government to get help with moving around the globe or doing international business. And you know what was even more than that that struck me? I talked to my colleagues in the Caribbean tax administrations, and I remember a conversation with one of my friends from the Jamaican tax administration, and I said, okay, surely you see black-owned businesses, you know, doing international trade, international business. In her 20 years, she told me she had never seen a black-owned business, not one.
Wow.
I said, how is that possible? Because you're Jamaica, wow. You know? And she said, because the businesses that come to us in order to help them with international expansion are white-owned businesses. So after George Floyd, two things happened to me. George Floyd happened, and I started to question myself on how I had spent my decades serving businesses outside of my community, questioning why I never saw black-owned businesses come to the government for help. And then there was a mandate for federal employees in order to have to get the vaccine. And the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan told us crystal clear, we weren't taking the vaccine. So I didn't care about how many decades I had been there. If you think you're going to force me to take a vaccine, it was deuces. So I knew I had to come up with a way in order to, you know, move my career to the next level or move my business. Now, I'm going to tell y'all, I am an entrepreneurial chicken. When I tell you chicken afraid, you would never pay me to believe that I have a successful business. But those two things really pushed me into a corner, and I just had to find a way to take my talent and bury it in my own community. I had just decided that the reason I didn't see any black-owned businesses is because, Melissa, you've been sitting in your good government job for 23 years, living as a diplomat around the world, burying all your talent outside of our community. And I decided I was absolutely done with that. And I took full responsibility for the fact that our businesses did not know that the government had all these resources that were available. And long story short, I met a marketing firm. They converted me into Black and Global, helped me figure out how to translate my talent. And now we're, 20 months later, and we're over 4,000 members.
Wow. That is a success story and an astonishing story, And I love how you took us through the history of everything, starting with the Million Man March until now, and how every incident and every event inspired and motivated and encouraged you to the next, to bring you to where you are today. That's fascinating. And as entrepreneurs, we all have a story. Right, it's in our own, it's in our own light, it's in our own right as far as how we got to where we are. But it is the passion that we claim that brings us to where we are. So thank you so much for sharing that. My next question to you, in regards to our topic today of the power of the black dollar, how have you seen the power of the black dollar being moved in this in the United States? And then now with the 4,000 members you have in your network, how it's being moved across the world?
Well, I mean, I'm going to tell you, when I say it's our time, I fundamentally believe that. You know, looking at the opportunities that are available in different parts of the world, it's quite incredible. When I'm telling you that there are billions of dollars in contract opportunities, I'm going to give you one example. So we, our organization, we help businesses to go to different government agencies, right? You pay your taxes. I pay my taxes. I know from working at the IRS how the tax dollars flow. And so you pay people to sit in embassies in 170 countries around the world. These are commercial officers, or they are economic officers, and their job is to go and get contracts for American businesses, right? That's their full-time job. You pay for them to do that. So I know what resources are available to assist businesses with those opportunities. But as an actual person or as a business, we weren't exporting. We were just helping people to be able to export. So I had an epiphany, and I said the U.S. government was doing the very first trade mission, quote-unquote minority trade mission, in the history of the U.S. government, right? That was last year, May 2022. And they had never done a trade mission focused on minority. Now, we are focused on black. We're not people of color. You know, we're not BIPOC or any of that. We are strictly focused on black-owned businesses. And so, and we focus on male and female. That's the other point for us that's really critical, because what you'll see in the messaging is for women. And so, and the focus will be on white women in particular, but they add black women to that, and that's not our focus. There's no way that in terms of business that we can rise as a community and you want to split us off from our man. That's not going to happen for black and global. So we're very, very clear that for us, we move out as a unified body, male and female. And so when we woke up, I woke up with this epiphany. I said, you know what? I'm going on this trade mission. And the other side of me said, but you don't sell anything. I said, that's all right. I follow a living God. Watch us go on this trade mission. And the thing that was so interesting about it was, when I tell you I don't compromise on who and what we are, I met with – the trade mission was to Italy, Portugal, and Spain. It was to Europe. It wasn't to Africa at that time, and it wasn't to the Caribbean. It was to Italy, Portugal, and Spain. But Allah hit me with the epiphany that said, no, go and open doors for our people. So I met with the teams in Milan, Italy, the embassy in Milan, the embassy in Portugal, and then the embassy in Spain. And I said to them, all three of them, that I want to meet with groups and trade industries that want to do business with black American businesses, crystal clear. Do you know we got over 200 requests to meet with us?
Wow.
We got over 200. I was blown by that. And we only met with 55 because we were only there for a week. We couldn't meet with that many people. But it really opened my eyes to the fact that people are really interested in doing business with our businesses. So when I tell you it's our time around the globe, only 5% of the market is here within the U.S., and that's why I tell businesses 95% of the market is around the world, and you really have to include international as a part of your business portfolio.
Awesome. That's one thing that I've been saying a lot on the show. 5% is in the United States, 95% is throughout the world, and I learned that from you. Specifically in the work that you do and following you. Right now, for those who just tuned in, we're talking to Melissa Muhammad, who is the founder and CEO of Black and Global Business Network. You can look on the website. It's blackandglobalbusinessnetwork.com and follow along. Right now, Melissa, I know the initiative that your organization has.
Can you repeat that information, please? Go slow.
It's blackandglobalbusinessnetwork.com. And throughout the interview, I will repeat again so everyone is aware of where we are and who we're speaking to and the amazing work that's being done right now. Melissa, also, right now I know the network is focusing for 2023, Black and Global is focused on Africa and the Caribbean, doing business in Africa and the Caribbean. Your organization has that experience working throughout the world, Asia, Europe, South America. Why Africa and the Caribbean? What is it right now that has propelled you to focus the organization on business for Black-owned businesses in Africa and the Caribbean?
Well, those are some tremendous markets. And the Caribbean, the diaspora, they're looking for the diaspora to bring their skills and talents home. Last year when we had our very first, no, 2021 when we had our very first virtual summit, we weren't even registered as an organization at that time, and we had, for our virtual summit, over 1,100 attendees from 58 countries. And one of the groups that was on our program was the African Tax Administration Forum. Why tax? Because, you know, that's my wheelhouse, and I had relationships with them. So what was so interesting is that when I reached out to them to say, hey, you know, we're going to have this summit and I would love for you to have conversations about doing business on the continent because I know business is a tax game, right? And so, and they said to me, Melissa, I can't believe that you reached out to us because we were looking for a way to bridge with Black American and Black American businesses and talent. And she said that we created a database, we're working on a database where we're looking for the diaspora to register their talent so that when we need this type of assistance that we can reach out to the diaspora in order to provide the talent. Right now, we go to the Netherlands and to Norway and all of these other areas in order to do to get the assistance that we need. And I said, what kind of assistance are you needing? And she said, engineering, technology, website development. And I said, really, you need those levels of skills? And she said, yeah, that's what we're looking for. And so we needed to bridge with a group that we could reach out to and we can have a database and say, look, we need this service. Can you support us with this service? And then this is what she said that was so key. She said, listen, I'm not talking about in kind. We pay people for these services, and we're paying money to these other countries, and none of the people that we're paying are Black. So we want to work with your group so that we can hire people from the U.S. because you all have the best talent. Now, that's what they said to me from Africa. That was a pin in my head in 2021. Mm. Then we also had from CARICOM in the Caribbean a speaker, and this was the Deputy General of CARICOM. And the Deputy General of CARICOM said to me, now CARICOM is similar to the United Nations, but it's for the Caribbean. It's made up of all of these different Caribbean countries, and they handle many, many different areas, but for my area specifically is related to trade. So he said to me, Melissa, we see the Chinese, the Russians. Now, this was 2021. We see the Chinese, the Russians, white Europeans, white Americans, white Canadians. Where are the Black American people? We're right here in your backyard. And I said, you know, I can't tell you why we're not there. I'm sure there's a lot of work that's happening there. But what I can tell you is that we will create a bridge through Black and Global. So I agreed to do that with both of these areas. And so I'm happy to share that just 2 weeks ago, we were in the Caribbean on a trade mission, the very first Black and Global trade mission, again, which is shocking to me as a non-entrepreneurial person. But we took a delegation to the Caribbean National Association of Telecommunication organizations, over 300 companies we met with. We signed a partnership agreement with them, and what does that mean? That what they said to me is, we purchase 100, we import 100% of what we buy for all of our telecom hardware, software, you name it, graphic designs, website, we purchase everything. Cell phone towers, mobile, everything. 90% of our vendors that we buy from, right? These are over 300 companies. 95% of our vendors that we buy from are from the U.S., and not one company is black. Not one company is black. And their secretary general told me, Melissa, she said, we have to do business with you. We have to do business with you. So she said, bring your companies, meet us in Suriname, and we will form a partnership agreement so that, and showcase Black and Global, so that our vendors, our companies can buy from your companies. See, so this is why I can tell you for sure. So for me, I'm interested in the contract. The relationship is great, but as a lawyer, you know, I'm interested in the money and in signing the contract. So it's just incredible to see that around the world. And I'm going to tell you, I get so surprised, and I know for people who have been entrepreneurs a long time, it may be a little bit different. But I've had a job, you know, for over 20 years and never wanted to own a business. So for me to now own a business and really see, oh, my goodness, there are so many opportunities. Now, and I've seen the opportunities for the other communities because I've done it for so long. But to really be able to take my talent and now put it in a way that I can identify opportunities. On this trade mission, we identified 24 contract opportunities and partners. 24.
Wow.
Like literally, we sat and we had a room. They brought in different people, the minister from Barbados, the minister from this country. We want to buy this. We want to buy that. And I'm just sitting there like, is this really me? I'm a little country girl from Oakville, Georgia. But it's great. So I can just say that to say, I can tell you definitively, those two parts of the world. And I'm going to tell you the last reason about Africa. So, and this is what I really want people to understand. When I tell you that the continent, that there is a fight for the economics on the continent of Africa, it is extremely true. And it's the Chinese and the Americans. So let's be clear. There's no beneficence from these people that they love us so much or that the American government wants to help us so much. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with the fact that China is dominating in the Caribbean and they're dominating on the continent. And the U.S. is behind the game, and they're trying to come up with ways to compete against China. And the question is, who's going to penetrate that market faster? Is it going to be Black American people, or is it going to be non-Black American people? And they are crystal clear that it's Black American people. But we're not going to be lost by that because we're going to take advantage of this opportunity. But the fact is, we don't go in with a kumbaya mindset, and we don't go in with a colonial mindset. We go in with the mindset of serving our people and getting paid. We're not coming for charity or to bring aid. We're coming to bring skills and resources and to get paid in return. So the market that is developed there, it's 1.3 trillion. It's 1.3 billion people. That's what the issue is 1.3 billion people. So nope, it's not love. It's money. It's money that's the issue.
And I'm so glad you said that and you broke it down the way you did so powerfully and exact. Talk about briefly, and then we're going to open up for Q&A, but please, if you can, please list as many business sources, resource types that the continent is looking for, African continent is looking for, the Caribbean is looking for, the diaspora. What exactly? You mentioned telecom, you mentioned engineering. Just list as many as you can.
As many as, oh, wow. I mean, so let me add one extra thing. The U.S. government, this is how focused they are on Africa. December 2022, They had the Biden had a U.S. Africa summit. There was a business forum tied to that. 22 companies to meet with 14 different representatives from 14 different African nations at this meeting. And why did we do that? Because we know for 2023, they're focused on taking a delegation to the African continent in order to do business deals. This is the second trade mission focused on minority businesses, and it's called the Global Export Diversity Initiative. That's going to be to South Africa, Ghana, and Nigeria. Yep, that's it. Those are the three. And there's a trade mission that's happening in March going to Tanzania and to Kenya. Again, Global Export Diversity Initiative. And we've already met with those teams because we're helping companies to prepare to go on these this trade mission. But after that meeting in December, Ex-Im Bank, which is the U.S. Export-Import Bank, and again, I tell people, I know this going to sound crazy, but trust me when I tell you, the American government will loan money to foreign companies to buy from you. I'm going to say that one more again. The American government will loan money to foreign companies to buy from you. And Ex-Im Bank entered into an MOU with the Africa Ex-Im Bank to the tune of $500 million. That was done December 20th, 2022. So I'm on in the vanguard position for our people, right? That's how the minister teaches us to think. Think for the whole. Don't think for yourself. I'm in the vanguard position for our people. So when I get this information, I'm looking at how this money can be trickled into our community because I know the game of the talk, but I know how to flow the cash as well. And so when we go through this process, this is why I'm preparing companies to go on these trade missions because the trade missions will be filled with people, but none of them will be us. And look now, they do minority. It doesn't say black. It's minority. So you'll have a lot of minority people on these trade missions, but they won't look like us. But I'm not crying saying, oh, woe is me. I'm saying, no, Melissa, if there are no black people on these trade missions, it's because you're not doing your job. So you have to do the work in order to get the black people to go on the trade missions. So when I tell you the areas or the sectors that are going to be covered, it's a kajillion. It's a kajillion of them. But I'm just going to give you some ideas. Professional services, legal, accounting, marketing. Look at this one. Content management. That one blew me away. I was like, I don't understand. You all need content managers because what happened? During COVID, people built up their website, but they didn't continue to maintain their website. They didn't continue to update the information. I never knew that was a thing. I had to struggle on my own business with understanding content marketing. So those are some of the sectors. Then you have cybersecurity is ginormous. Every country we go to needs ICT, cybersecurity. They're looking at smart cities, AI. They're looking at automotive parts for sure, automotive vehicles, automotive cars, electric vehicles, anything related to batteries. Fintech is huge. What else have I seen? Waste management is also very, very big. Solar, renewable energy, like Black and Global, we are doing a project with the Bahamas where we're bringing the Bahamas a reverse trade mission to the U.S. to meet with black renewable energy companies. Why? Because they receive funding in order to do renewable energy projects. I read their renewable energy strategy, and I say, hey, look at here. Part of this money is going to have to come to our community. So I reached out to them, and I said, black people have renewable energy companies, too. Come and look at our companies. And the people accept it. clothing, manufacturing. I was just on a call with Italy yesterday, and they said, Melissa, do you have any fashion? Let me get it right. Fashion Institute, or so the University of Milan has fashion students, black fashion students, and they need mentors. That's what it is, because I was talking with the U.S. Embassy in Milan, and they need mentors, and we were wondering if Black and Global would mentor them of how to do business in the U.S., how to bring their brands to the U.S. So, you know, now I'm looking at, okay, where are fashion and industry people? So there are so if it is sold in the U.S., this is what I tell people. If it's sold in the U.S., if it's hair products, beard products, hair cutting products, anything you see sold in the U.S. will be sold around the world. So it's so many different industries, shoes, luggage. I mean, I see requests for kayak boats. Like there was one hotel that reached out to us because they're doing adventure tours in Africa, and they wanted to buy kayak boats. So Melissa is looking for a black kayak boat maker. So it's so many different areas.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And for those who are tuning in right now, we are speaking to Melissa Muhammad. She is the founder and CEO of Black and Global Business Network.com. Please look her up in the organization. We're opening for Q&A. I know the phone lines are hot right now, Brother Bilal, aren't they? I mean, people's minds should be just teeming with questions about how to move to the next step. What do you think, Brother Aziz?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Brother Bilal, Brother Aziz, please.
Go ahead,
I want to
I'm overwhelmed, I'll tell you that much. Go ahead, Bilal.
Wa alaikum salam, sir.
And let me say, sister, you are, to hear from you is, I can't say how much of a pleasure, because for the last 8 years, this New Africa Black Belt Wall Street have been on this generally on the subject of just about everything you're speaking of. Let me just say, I am a licensed certified financial planner, and I've been having my own brokerage for over 40 years. And I can say that when you start, first of all, many of the subjects that you're talking about, let me just go back to what the federal government and redlining. That was something that was instituted way back in the early 40s. And, of course, the redlining, as we know, is where the federal government actually started redlining. And the federal government, along with state governments, along with other all-white businesses, intentionally are saying that they wanted to keep businesses out of the black community and make certain that equity does not grow in the black community. Up until just a few years ago, African Americans could not even get equity out of their own homes because this is what they, again, because of this law that was passed by our legislators that says that they want to make certain that they keep large monies out of the black communities, and especially and of course, if you don't have monies, equities, in your community, and your community is no more than a ghost town. So saying that to say, when you say that, and I can certainly, I can understand, but when you say that you've been many, many places, and the question have been asked, why isn't there any black businesses here? Why isn't there any black businesses there? Why isn't there any black businesses heard of? Our own federal government, along with all of the financial institutions in this country, are intentionally making us consumers. And right here in the United States, with all of the talents that we have in our communities, because, again, I can't think of anything that white folks or white businesses have that black businesses do not know how to do. But at the same time, because of this system of redlining, and just let me say this, in 2000, last year's consumer spendings in this country was $1.4 trillion. This year, it is projected to be $1.8 trillion consumer spendings. And again, we're 95 or more percentage consumers. So again, with our resources, our funds, all of our funds, even the funds that we put into our churches and mass jets and what have you, all of it goes into white banks. Everything we do go to the white community. And it's been that way for now over 100 years. So, and that redlining law has never changed. It was started when the New Deal by Harry Truman years ago. Our president just started the first New Deal when he came into the office a couple years ago. He started the first New Deal, and this first New Deal, you've heard him, is a State of the Union address as to where a huge amount of monies are being invested into the new developments of this country, because our infrastructure has become so old. And so now we want to build a brand new infrastructure all over this country, which is going to the federal government is willing to put out trillions of dollars for this new infrastructure and this new deal. But at the same time, under this new deal, I haven't heard not one single proposal that makes African Americans a part of the New Deal. And we was directly taken away from the original New Deal that was started over 100 years ago. And today, like I said, redlining has never been overturned. So again, why would the federal government have it known to African Americans that all of these opportunities are available to you in many parts of the world, but we're specifically interested in Africa, but even the European markets, they are all saying the same thing. Where is the African American? And we know this African American has plenty of talent, but where is the African American? Again, sister, we are here, but we have been shut out, and like I said, when you're being shut out by your own federal government, of course that's going to federal government, state governments, and any kind of other large businesses are all practicing the same thing, racism. And so again, my question, my statement is why would the federal government, and it's good that you said a couple months ago, the president, when he just had the African summit, because I didn't see any activity, again, for African Americans, even when they had that African summit, but saying that there is something proposed for African Americans, and when you say minorities, of course, white women are minorities. And so, but my statement to us all is why would there be announcements announcing the African Americans as a business entity in any interest that the United States would have, when it's the United States' own federal government that is practicing redlining and racism. So you have any comments on on the red line.
Sure. So, you know, I think the key point is it's not in their interest to promote us.
Yes.
And it's in their interest to keep black people subjugated. And as their world disintegrates, it is now and reaching for a lifeline. That's why we're very clear. They're not here to do us any favor. And that's why when we go to the government agencies, we are not asking for anything. See, that's the difference with me knowing how the process works. So, for example, we take businesses on what we call a government export ecosystem tour because we want to teach you how to fish, right? So, because so the mission is much bigger than we can do as individuals. We don't expect any beneficence from the government, not on any level. My issue is don't stand in our way. We want the same thing that anybody else gets. And if you tell us that we can't have that, then that's when I have a problem. So there hasn't been an announcement for black or African-American businesses. During the summit, one of the statements that President Biden made was that America's African diaspora is our greatest strength, right? And so, but what the difference for me, and listen, I'm sure there are many organizations that have come before Black and Global. You know, there are many groups that work now that have paved the way that are doing tremendous things that I know nothing about. Our contribution is simply built around my skill set of working with government. And what the marketing company that I use, when I say they translated me to the world, I thought my skill set will be I can negotiate billion-dollar deals for us. But what they helped me understand is that my bigger skill set is I know how the government works. And not only do I know how the government works domestically in the U.S., because I've worked with government officials in over 150 countries, I know how they work around the world. So packaging that to open doors for our people. So when you're saying what an announcement about African-American people, this is Black and Global saying, here's what we want and here's what we're looking for. And so I tell our team all the time, we have great, amazing people. I'm telling you, we have been so blessed to attract some really top talent. And again, as a baby entrepreneur, it scares me the level of people that have poured their skills and talents into Black and Global. But I tell them all the time, when things go well and the government is doing what they're supposed to be doing, you're going to all these offices, they're returning your emails, they're returning your phone calls, they're setting up the meetings for you, they're telling you about the services that are available. That's what should happen with any company. And so equipping our companies to go through that process, because many times as an entrepreneur, you don't want to fool with the paperwork. The government is an absolute hassle. And so, but Black and Global, what makes us unique is we do the paperwork, and we know how to facilitate through the paperwork, and we become the international business development team. So as long as our businesses are going to each of these government offices, they're between 7 and 10 that we work with, depending on where you are in the process. As long as we get what anybody should get that is an American company that is going, I have no problems. And I tell our team all the time, things are going smooth, that's you all's job. But when we don't get what we're supposed to get, then that's my time. Because I am a wartime consigliere, and I am built to fight for my people. And you are not going to tell me what doors can't open for my people, because I've sat in these seats for over 20 years, so I'm clear about that. So when you say redlining, that definitely is the history, but we're not going to the government expecting them to hand us anything. I'm not asking for anything. We say, this is what we want. Do this, 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 and this. And that's the difference with us, because when we go in the door, we do a strategic plan for every company that we work with before you walk in the door. And so a lot of times when companies go to the government, you don't know what to say, how to say it. There's certain things you shouldn't say. Oh, no, we don't do that. We walk in the door and say, here are the things that we want. Do this, 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 and this. Because you can't tell us, you know, what we can't do. Now, you can add to what we're talking about, and you can give us some advice for sure. But, you know, those closed doors, that's not rocking for me. And the other thing I'm gonna share with you about the white women issue. I had this conversation yesterday, and I had this conversation with the head of the U.S. Commercial Services when we were in Italy. I said, you all, Biden is purporting a definition of minority as white women, and that doesn't work for us. This is exactly what I told him. You are promoting the definition of minority as white women. And I said, I'm telling you crystal clear, black people not going to be left out. I'm telling you right now, you all are going to have to change that messaging. You see my tone? See, I have an I follow Farrakhan mentality. That's how I operate. Because you're not going to tell me that you're going to sit up here and open the door for all of these companies around the world and tell them that diversity is white women. No, that's not going to work. I'm going to be a huge thorn in your side, and the youngest people on earth are on the continent of Africa. So either we can work, I can work with you, or I can work against you. Either way works for me. So, but we're not going to be left out of the conversation. So I was talking with them yesterday, and they said, oh, Melissa, you're right. We're reshaping the messaging. We're changing the messaging. See, you have to have somebody like the minister who is willing to say what has to be said and not be afraid of consequences. And I'm not. I just really am so grateful to have found a lane where I can serve because, you know, many of us, we're so talented, but we have to have a job and we got to pay our bills. And if you like me, you were scared to step out on your own. Absolutely chicken entrepreneur. That's what I call myself. But now we're in a position where the time has changed. And the last thing I'll say to that when you talk about the government is e-commerce. E-commerce changes the game for our people. Many of our people, they don't just have one job. They have a side hustle. And if you're smart, you won't be limiting your revenue to just one stream of income. And if you do e-commerce, then you can do international business. And I'm going to tell you right now, the U.S. government has an office that's called the E-Commerce Lab. And what do? They help you to increase your SEO in whatever countries you want to go to so you come up at the top of the Google search or whatever search it is. And how much does it cost you for the U.S. government to analyze your website to do that? A whopping $100. See, that's what we teach our companies. And when they tell us, you want to take your company into Ghana, you want to take your company to Jamaica or to the UK, here's what needs to happen on this SEO. They'll give us a full report to tell us that. And then that costs a lot of money. But then guess what? The U.S. government has grants to help businesses to get their websites redone, and Black and Global has an internal team that will turn around and help you get your company up to speed so that you can be at the top of the search in those countries. See, I'm a very practical person. I'm very results-oriented and very results-driven, and so I'm not focusing on, you know, understanding that the government is not kumbaya. I'm not expecting them to help us. I'm demanding what it is that I pay my tax dollars for.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Sister, dynamic.
Brothers and sisters, our mics are open. I've opened all of the mics. So if you can hear the sister.
Yes, I have a question.
Yes, go right ahead.
I would like to make a comment to Sister Melissa. Salam alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Can you hear me? Yes,
yes,
this
ma'am.
This is Aisha Abdul Ali. I'm very happy to hear of the work that you are doing in the international arena, and I truly do pray that you continue to be out there on the front line and do great work for all of humanity and the African American people especially. I am one of those that you mentioned earlier, the pioneers in this field of international business. And there are quite a few of us, but not as many. Back in the 90s, there was a program, there was a training that was offered by the D.C. Office of International Business in conjunction with Ex-Im Bank, as you mentioned, Export-Import Bank there in Washington, D.C. This program was designed by the U.S. government to help large corporations, the management of large corporations, to start exporting products from the U.S. The U.S. was losing position in the global export market. There was no communication or identification of this program, but happily, unfortunately, I was working for the D.C. government at the time, and I heard about it. And, of course, being from old school Panther in the 60s and 70s, of course, I made a ruckus of it and was insistent that I be included in that program. Well, fortunately, they kind of gave in, and I was included in the program. I did receive a certification in international trade from this prestigious program, and that certification did launch me, but, however, there were a lot of discrimination because here I am, this African-American female with CEOs of major corporations, and they weren't going to allow that. They didn't want that site. So long story short, the comment that I would like to make is that there are those of us out there. And one of the issues that we began to realize is that it's great, and it's amazing that you are such a great advocate for our community and our people. And the end of this spectrum that you serve in is extremely important. However, there's another end that is also important, and this is what we found out. Very few of our people understand the processes of international trade, the fundamentals, the freight forwarding, how you get your product there and how you get your insurance and all of those things are extremely important for our people to successfully export. If we don't, we're going to lose out. Fortunately, you are there to interpret contracts and to advocate for us, and that is a front end. But this back end has to be taken care of. And I would say to you, if you are in a position to get with some of the universities and to get them to offer, the ones who have the skills and the talent faculty, to offer a course in international trade and development on their campus, to help the community learn the processes. Mm-hmm. Now, we did this at North Carolina Central University in Durham for 3 semesters. I taught the course because I was certified and developed the course. And now we need another generation. The information hasn't changed that much, but our people must. And I would hope that you would encourage the individual companies who want to go into international trade to learn the international processes of getting your product from the U.S. to the destination where it's supposed to go. Because you know the other front end. Yeah. So those are my comments, and hopefully they are be of use.
Yes, ma'am. What's your name again?
Aisha Abdul-Ali.
Okay, yes, ma'am. Okay, Sister Aisha, first of all, let me say, you're hired.
No, I'm not.
Let me say why I say that. We actually do have a training program. We have a global readiness program, and you're so talking my language because this is the first steps that we teach. We teach the basics of import, exporting, the terminology, understanding the process. We actually have black freight forwarders. We have black insurance carriers, shipping companies. So one of the things that was very important to us is pulling together global, black global professionals. And we have brought them into the fold so that we can teach our own people about international business. And you are 1,000% correct, because when we want to make sure that as you go to these government offices, you know the language of international business. And even if you don't fully understand it, because it takes a while to get there, when they know certain key words that you are aware of, they're clear that you have knowledge about international business. So we actually have a training program that's called VIP Essentials. And VIP Essentials is a training program with the very basics of, one, your mindset, because you have to set your mind for international business, because international business is very lucrative. It's very, very lucrative, but it's not easy. And so we don't do easy. We do lucrative, and we do successful. And so setting your mindset for that is the first thing we teach. And then after that, we start to teach businesses about actually all of the different steps and the parts. And do you know that the U.S. government and the Department of Commerce, their basic exporting 101 guide is 243 pages long? 200.
Yeah, I can believe that.
I said to them, who on earth? It's going to, this in and of itself tells you you're not talking to small businesses. So Black and Global, we were appointed to Ex-Im Bank's Small Business Committee. And one of the reasons that we were appointed to the Small Business Committee is because they want to hear from Black-owned businesses, and they want to hear how to make the process easier, what have been some barriers to entry. Ex-Im Bank has participated in each of our summits each year. And the delegation that we just took to the Caribbean, so I said to them, listen, what I want to do, because you're looking for innovative ideas, I want to pre-qualify projects. So I want to be able to send you companies and send you projects, and you look at the projects and the companies and pre-qualify them and tell me whether or not this is something that can be done. So they said, Melissa, we will pre-qualify your projects and pre-qualify your companies. When they land on the ground in the Caribbean, they'll be pre-qualified. So listen now, this is the lip service they paid to me when I went to their conference in December. So being the government person that I am, I didn't wait on them to create a form, a project form, to send to me to say, this is what should be in the project form for them to review. I created the form myself, and I created the project proposal form because I know how to do government forms. So I created the form, sent it to them. They said, oh, Melissa, this is great. I said, okay, so this is the form we're going to be using in order to pre-qualify our projects, because I want to make sure that before we go down this road that this is something that you will finance. So, again,
well, you know,
that's why I'm saying that we're riding on the legacy of a lot of people who have worked. That I'm very clear on. And, you know, one of my other failures is being so disconnected from the black business community because I have invested my time, so much of my time in the other community. But what we're doing at Black and Global is making the process workable for our small businesses with the paperwork, right, the administrative part, understanding how to tick all the boxes, because the government will shut you down because you don't tick the right boxes. Oh, no. We do video trainings in order to teach people how to fill out forms. One of our services is our team will pull the form up for you on the screen, ask you all the questions, fill out every blank for you, send you a PDF of what you told us. You check it. Tell us if it's right. We'll submit the paperwork for you. We'll set up the meetings for you. We will track the deals for you. We write the contracts for you. Oh, no. You know, really, I designed Black and Global to be for people like me who are administratively challenged.
And you know what? And let me testify to that. Let me testify to that as a client of Black and Global, because there was, and to go into what you were saying, Melissa, about the summit that took place, I followed up with the summit, although I wasn't able to attend the D.C., the African summit that was hosted by the U.S. government. I followed up and I contacted all the consulates who were available at that summit in regards to business. And I heard back, I think I contacted like five and I heard back from three of them. Two or three of them, and had meetings with them. And immediately they pitched the government version of you all was called Golden Key, right? And the only thing that this agency does is just set up meetings for the contract. They only set up you as the contractor and then the country representative. That's it. They don't teach you anything about the language. They don't walk through the process or nothing like that. And of course, you have to pay for that still, and it's not cheap. You have to pay for just a meeting. What Black and Global does is depending on where you are with your knowledge or lack of knowledge, or just you're learning the business anew, they take you from where you are and they move with you and they represent you, because they want to empower Black-owned businesses to be successful in the international level. So therefore, once I made the connection to these countries, Morocco and Kenya and such, immediately set up that, said, okay, well, I'll let you know what my next move is, and immediately contacted the representatives of Black and Global, and they've been handling everything. And so things are moving aligned. You know, they are streamlined right now into the next steps. And so we're getting into the contracts and the conversations and the next steps. So, yeah, definitely. And the education is there. The education is constantly there. Black and Global, if you go to their website, Black and Global Business Network, they're constantly having seminars and webinars. And this
So, Brother Bilal, to answer your question, why is the U.S. government interested in the African-American community doing international business? I think that was a question that you had.
Yes,
well,
sorry.
Hello. Yes.
Sorry, just before you get started,
yes.
Because it is time to switch over to your show. But but before I switch over and you take over your show, I wanted to inform you that we have a brother from Sierra Leone. He's been on before. And along with the information that we are hearing tonight, I'd like for you to hear what he has to inform you of and see where we go with really being sort of proactive and doing business in Africa.
Absolutely. I have no problem with that. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, then what I am going to do, and I'm telling everybody, at the 8 o'clock hour, Black Belt Wall Street switches over to Sister Aisha out of North Carolina, and she will be taking over from here. But the brother from Sierra Leone, if you would, I'd like for him to come on and make a statement, and then you can take it from there. So the brother out of Michigan, brother, are you with us? I'm sorry.
I'm here.
Give us
Usman,
your name.
Usman Darame.
Usman
Darame.
Take it from there.
Yes. It's really very, very interesting. What I've heard is interesting. And like the sister was saying, we got to be proactive. And in that regard, I have shared some information with my brother, Bynum. But yes, you know, I know what they are trying to do, you know, because like the reason why China is winning in Africa, I think if you remember, Mandela told, when Mandela was here, he went to Cuba, and then some people were questioning why he went to Cuba. And he just gave a simple reason that your enemy is not my enemy. And to tell you the truth, people, Africans, we don't forget like that. you know, China has been, maybe this is not important, but I'd like to maybe enlighten some people on that. China has been the provider of the bullet that we use for all to be able to free Africa. So, you know, and that is at the back of the African mind. And at least they are trying to bring our brothers up front before this fight. And it's a good idea for all to see our brothers over there. But we have to also remember that, you know, they have a saying in Africa, say the monkey can never leave his black hand. So as we join them to go forward what we are doing, we have to remember, again, what Brother Malcolm said. He said, when they join you, end up where you don't intend to go. But anyway, that being said, Sister Melicia, you have a lot of information and stuff like that, and we can put up some solid programs because I have an idea, being an African, and I've lived in America for about 50 years. I've been a mechanical engineer, environmental, and health in the area of health. So I know exactly some of the things that are on the priority list for development. So we can be able for to be proactive and just design the programs and just take the programs and move forward. I don't want to take too much time, but I've shared a lot of information with Brother.
You want to leave your email address, how maybe Melissa can get in touch with you and all of us? You have an email or
definitely,
what?
Definitely. Yeah. I would like for me to get her own information. I think I've gone while we are talking, I went to the website, I saw her there, and but my email address is you want it now?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's all lowercase letters. Usman, USMAN Darami ARAMY@gmail.com. That's my first name, last name, @gmail.com. And my telephone number is 313-610-6733. And I've been looking for this. I've been working on this for a long, long, long time. Really try for me to link black know-how, African-American know-how to African needs. And everything is just for place. And sister, if I can have your phone number just in case, I will appreciate it too.
Yes, I was just about to say that. Thank you, Brother Usman, for that information. Before we close out, Sister Melissa Muhammad, thank you again for joining the show. Please leave everybody with general contact information, info, that they could reach out to your organization.
Okay, yes, thank you. So thank you all for having me tonight. It's been a great conversation. The best way to reach me is on our website. If you go to contact us, and you will see an email address that is us@blackandglobalbusinessnetwork.com. So the website itself is www.blackandglobalbusinessnetwork.com, and the email address again is us@blackandglobalbusinessnetwork.com. Thank you.
Thank you again. This has been a wonderful event, a wonderful discussion. Sister Aisha, we turn it over to you, and very much
Brother
appreciate
Bilal.
You, Sister Melissa.
Yes.
Sister Melissa, I think Brother Bilal has a statement.
Sister Melissa,
Brother Bilal?
Yes, sir.
And we're not rushing you off, believe it or not. You can stay on for the entire conclusion of the show because we do like your participation. But let me just inform you and many of the listeners who may not know about this, we are trying to put together a delegation, and we want to actually go to Africa. We don't know what part. We haven't put together our business plan or anything yet, but our objective is to put together a delegation of about 100 or maybe 200 investors. each one of the investors, including myself, would put up $10,000 or could be committed to a $10,000 investment in whatever business we decide to put into Africa. Now, the brother that I just spoke to, he's from Sierra Leone. And we were talking just a few days ago, and as a matter of fact, he sent me a diagram as to where he has property, beach, waterfront property in Sierra Leone, equaling some 14 acres. And, of course, we would like to put up a resort, a hotel along with housing resort, somewhere in Africa. So with that said, I would now turn it back over to you, Sister Aisha, but this is one of the proactive things that we would like to do, and we'd like to be able to do it this year, but we're just now waiting on the investors who are will be committed to a $10,000 investment. And again, we're not asking anybody to send New Africa Business Association one dime. We're just saying that if you are a person who would like to invest in Africa, and I know we've been talking to those who have been talking about business and dual citizenship in Africa, this is what we would like to continue to know more about, but at the same time, we would like to put together that delegation to go to some parts of Africa. And yes, but Sierra this particular brother has a...
we're going to Sierra
Leone. Go right ahead.
Yes.
I'm going to turn it back over to Sister Aisha, and I'll let her go
yes,
back to you.
Just a second. I would like to... Yes, brother, we are talking about Sierra Leone as a possible place. Sister Melissa Muhammad, can you give your comments on what Brother Bilal just mentioned? Do you see any possibility of this type of business relationship developing? Is she still there? Hello? Are you still there, Sister Melissa?
Sister Muhammad, leave.
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can now.
Oh, okay.
We can now. Did you hear
okay.
my statement?
I did, and I heard Brother Bilal as well. So I definitely can see that. There are many different projects that you are able to invest in, and one of the things that's beneficial about the U.S. Embassy, and again, remember, you don't have to go through the government in order to import or export or to do investments, but our process does, right? We have the government to vet every deal that is done in advance before we do any business deals in any country around the world, not just Africa. So they're definitely projects. There's a cashew project in Tanzania that I absolutely know is looking for investors right now, and they're looking to be on the Dar es Salaam Stock Exchange, and we're talking with them about a project through the Africa Exim Bank and doing a cashew project with the University of Toronto in Canada. Actually, we're having our I want to invite you all to join our webinar, which is going to be held tomorrow night, and it's going to be from 7:30. You can go on our website to get more information. But we're going to be talking about with the Canadian Black Chamber of Commerce about exactly what you're saying. They're looking to do projects from Canada in Africa, and we're looking for companies that are doing projects. So to answer your question, there are many, many, many projects that you can do. And as you build your fund, you definitely, you know, my expertise would only be on the international side. And I would encourage you to vet projects through different through different government offices that are on the ground there. Your state also has hired contractors in different parts of Africa, and depending on where you're incorporated, in order to find you projects. So there are many projects that you can do. Affordable housing is very in high demand. I mean, very high demand on the continent. So when you're talking about a resort and you're talking about building housing, you know, there's just a tremendous opportunity. Listen, if you have money to invest, then there's definitely, this is the opportunity and the time in order to do that, because the doors are just wide open, especially, I'm sure you all know about the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement and what that's going to do, making it one marketplace, and they're looking for investors. So the answer is most definitely yes.
Thank you very much. And Brother Usman, did you have any other comments you want to make to Sister Melissa and to the audience before we change direction?
Yes, you know, I have some ideas where, you know, we can be able for to work with her, you know, with innovative ways of really making it work. And, you know, and I am going to suggest even if 10 or 10 projects, like what I'm talking about, like the site where Brother Biden mentioned, what we want to do really is to build a factory on that site wherein we can, you know, manufacture engineer building materials to support the housing need that she's talking about. And we are going to use resources, for example, like rice straws from a technology that is developed in Germany. And probably I'm going to maybe talk about that, how we can be able to access it, and probably use our African American Black Farmers Associations, so we can be able for all to manufacture the engineer building materials on that site, that we can be able for all to really build houses everywhere. That is those are the type
Thank
of things
you.
We are talking about.
Thank you very much. And we certainly would like for everyone to come back, Brother Usman and Sister Melissa. And I would think that the producers of the economic portion of our program would also be delighted if you all will come back at some point and share your thoughts with us and let us know of the progress that you're making.
We didn't open our mics up. There might be others out there, because we do have a large audience that may want to ask the question or make a comment to the sister before she leaves. So, again, if you don't mind, our mics are open, and we welcome your comments.
So if anyone out there would like to make a comment to the sister before she leaves and to Brother Usman, please do so. We would like to, especially Sister Melissa, we would like to hear your comments and your questions. So go right ahead.
Yes, this is our Brother Aziz and Assalamu alaikum, Sister Melissa and the group. My question to Sister Melissa is, if you are a person, number one, does Africa have needs for certain things, let's say from toothpaste, Band-Aids, and things like that? Is there a demand for that from Africa? Just regular common goods?
Wa alaikum salam, and yes, sir, most definitely. And not just Africa, but the Caribbean as well. But yes, sir.
Well, you know, Brother Andy, those items that you were talking about, they are, in my experience, have shown me, being on the continent, that those items from the U.S. are in high demand, because hopefully the quality will continue to be better than from many of the other countries. Now, the U.S. government also has a unique program, and sometimes you have to inquire about it. Because the U.S. government has a need to export, you can't have a strong economy if you don't constantly export. Many of the manufacturers in the U.S. will work with an exporter, a company that's exporting, to bring their services and their products to assist you to bring them to the continent. And they will forego a lot of the expense after a period of time for bringing those products into the country. And in many, as far as heavy equipment, many of the companies in the U.S. will actually send their people in to train the people in Africa to use the equipment and the machinery and export, pay to export that machinery into Africa. So the U.S. government, and I'm sure Sister Melissa knows about this, they have many programs to facilitate exporting. Because
yeah,
if we don't export, we can't generate revenue for the country.
Right.
Exactly.
Did you find that to be the case, Sister Melissa?
The big thing that they do is, can you all hear me?
I
think there's an airplane flying over. So one of the things to consider is when you go, so one of the reasons why the U.S. government places resources behind exporting is because it creates jobs in the U.S., and so that's why they'll put money behind it. So one of the things that we do is we teach our companies throughout our process how to create at least 5 jobs, right? So because you have to in order to support this international contract, you have to have jobs here in the U.S. And we work with the Department of Labor that has resources that will actually help you create jobs. So if you're selling your products internationally in that way, they do have a number of programs. And so on the domestic side, you would work with an office that's called the SBDC, but the international, the Small Business Development Center, but they have international divisions, international centers, which are quite different from the normal one, and they have different programs that they work through in order to help exporters. So, for example, let's say if you want to export to Ghana, and we work with the embassy in Ghana, one of the things we would look at is distribution companies for you, because depending on how much of a pallet you can fill or how much of a ship or a crate you can fit, you want to partner with other companies that are bringing products into Ghana, right? So you can leverage that kind of relationship. So we go, and then you have to go through whether or not there are any type of special licenses you have to have. Does this product have any type, is it for medicinal purposes? So all of those are requirements that we help businesses to go through, but the U.S. government has a streamlined process. So we go to some countries, and I love that, you know, I don't have to go out to try to find people to do all this stuff for our companies. I just go to the embassy. They give me a list of 3 people to choose from. I interview 3 people, distribution companies, and I say we want to distribute this toothpaste, deodorant, soap, and lotion, these 4 products. And who is already distributing that I can partner my pallet with their pallet, lower the shipping costs to come into the country. So that, those are the types of things that we do in order to help the businesses to get their products there.
Well, thank you
so
much, Sister Melissa. Do we have any other questions or comments from the audience? All of our lines are full, so if you have comments or questions, please speak now. We only have about 20 minutes left on air before we have to go. So if we're not getting any other comments, Sister Melissa, thank you so much, and we would like to have you back at some time, and I'm sure that Saishta will handle that. Brother Usman, please do come back. I know this is your second time on air, at least your second time, and hopefully other individuals will chime in and give us their comment in the future, because this is an extremely important topic. So I would like for the next few minutes that we have on air, we need to talk about this issue of climate change and disaster relief. And we certainly would like some comments. We put some things out there week before last, and I did get some phone calls. And if any of the individuals who would like to make comments about climate change and the impact that it's having on our young people. I think that would be a great, good way to start. So if we have any questions or any comments. So if we do not, let's talk about the impact of climate change on our young people. We are finding that fear and anxiety amongst our young people has increased by 25% worldwide, and as well as in the United States. And when I would say our young people, we are talking about young people from the age of 3 all the way up to their teenage years. The school systems are beginning to experience this in the classroom with discipline issues and with behavior issues amongst our young people. Now, when our young people are faced with fear and anxiety, this causes psychosis. And mass psychosis in a society increases mental illnesses. So this is not something that we're going to have to turn our heads to or turn away from. We have to deal with the mental situation within the society. And if you know, remember in history, whenever there were large incidents of mental illness in the society, that was one of the major causes of the downfall of great societies. And so we want to be cognizant of this. Now, what can we do to help our young people with their fear and anxiety? Now, and you know that, of course, since the pandemic, anxiety in our young people has increased tremendously. Some of the signs, and you might want to think about this, and this is from JAMA, Pediatrics 2022. Some of the signs of this anxiety that we need to look for in our young people is anger, fear, worry, depression, learning issues, and being quick to get angry and become out of control. Those are some of the warning signs that parents need to start looking at. One of the things that we have found in our research and what the agencies or federal agencies are telling us is that when a family becomes prepared for a natural disaster, when they sit down, talk to their young people about natural disaster. Now, your children are hearing this in school, but if they are hearing it in school, they're hearing it in mass media, and if the family is not talking about it, it causes tremendous fear and anxiety within our young people. So parents, families, you're going to have to start having this conversation. If you sit with the children and talk about disaster preparedness, what are the techniques? How do you become prepared for a natural disaster? It gives them confidence. It increases their stability, and it empowers them with knowledge. And it also says to them that my family has it under control, and we know what to do. This is a small thing to do, but it has great implications if we do not do it. We cannot allow our young people to continue to have this fear and anxiety build up inside of them without us being aware of it and doing something about it. Because this fear and anxiety causes psychosis, and that is extreme mental illness. And I think many parents are seeing this in their children when they come to the school and say to the teachers and administration who are about to expel their son or daughter, I don't know what to do. I don't know why they're acting this way. Well, think about climate change. Think about the impact of the pandemic. We had a situation where we had to wear masks. Other countries throughout the world, the same thing. So we must talk about these issues with our young people. Yes. Are there any comments?
Yes, Sister Aisha Bilal. You know,
yes, go ahead.
Just recently, no more than a day or two ago, we had a shooting at Michigan State University. Now, the person who went on the campus and murdered these students, this person's and the reasons, although you're there, there should never be reasons, but the reasons that are given is that this young man, and he's this young man is in his late 20s or early 30s, but 2 years ago, his mother died. And before then, he was a normal, very well-mannered person. But 2 years ago, his mother died, and he went into a deep depression. This is a report from his father. And from this depression, there was a real bad demon that took this person over. It's totally meanness. And my question is, and it goes back to our conversation last week, and we've had this conversation many times, but within the last week or so, we know that in our school systems, only 10% of our teachers nationwide are African Americans, and most of those are females. The other 90% are white, Caucasian teachers, or something else other than African Americans. So again, and I use this, I know there's been many, many disasters as far as shootings and what have you. But I use this one, the most recent one, because, again, like it was reported, the young man's mother died. He went into a very deep depression, and that depression made him somewhat of a very bad person, or that brought out a very bad person. And this is what's happening not only with African-Americans, but Caucasians, but look like it's happening more with Americans, whether you're African-Americans or whether you're Caucasian-Americans. This type of depression is going on in our society. And I have my opinion about it. And I know when you start dealing with folks like Donald Trump and the millions of his followers and then the new politicians that are proposing to be our leaders, and the hate that is just being portrayed openly. And of course, with the bad problems of drug activities with our young folks. But my question is, what is the rescue? How do we prepare for a disaster such as the disasters that we ourselves and those who are within leadership, and especially in our schools, create this type of disaster? How do we, I'm going to use your word, how do we mitigate a situation like that?
You know, I don't know if I have all the answers for this, and I think it takes a great deal of expert opinion beyond my expert opinion. But I do know this, that we as parents, we must start being more accountable to the influences that our young people are being exposed to. many of our young people, they spend at least 7 to 8 hours per day, if not more, and this is what statistics tell us, on social media, on using technology, electronic devices, their cell phones or their computers. We as parents have no idea in most cases, in 90% of the cases, what they are looking at and what kind of influence is coming into their lives. We have given them this technology to pacify them we think it makes them smarter, but we are losing control of them, and other control mechanisms are taking over their lives. And this is contributing to all of this fear and anxiety as well. So when you think about our young people and you think about everything they are confronted with on a day-to-day basis, it's a wonder that many of them even want to get out of bed. They have peer relationships to deal with. They have school. They have social media. They have the discussion of the climate, the pandemic, to wear your mask, not to wear your mask. It's a lot to deal with. So I think that we are going to have to do a much better job. And no, it's not just African-American youth that's being confronted with all of these issues. It's all youth in America and in the world, because this data is based on world data, world population. So we have a huge job ahead of us, but the more we are prepared, the better. And when we sit down with our young people and give them responsibility when a disaster strikes and they know exactly what the family is going to do, they feel involved, and they do take ownership of helping the family survive. The statistics that say 70 to 80% of minorities are unprepared for a disaster, 70 to 80%, that data has not changed. So what are we going to do about it as parents and grandparents and great-grandparents? We're going to have to get in there, and we're going to have to prepare the family. We're going to have to become very knowledgeable of what to do. And, yes, in the next month or so, we will start back the disaster preparedness training. You can't get around it. If you aren't prepared, you're going to have some serious issues, and you might not survive. And if you're not prepared, where are your children going to go if there's a disaster in the middle of the day? Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? Can you imagine that they will be frightened? So I don't know if I answered your question. Any feedback from the audience?
Mics are open.
I was born in Africa, and I was raised in Africa, and I have children here, I raise my children over here. But one thing that you know, in Africa, the child, I don't know, we lose our rights. You know, they took our rights away from us.
Yes.
And you see, we didn't have no rights. So I still am happy that they took that right from me for at that particular time. And it did not mean to become a weak man. Much stronger. I can really stand anywhere, and even though they took my rights away from me. But we have to figure out a way of really taking the rights away, because I have seen it important. My being raised in Africa and raising boys in America, in the African and American community. The key thing here I can talk about is to take away the rights. I don't know how that's going to be done. And also,
Brother Usman, I don't think that we are talking about taking away their rights. It's not a question of rights.
I think what I'm trying to say is that that is what he did. That is what the solution in my case. That's what I'm saying. They took away my rights. You see?
I see.
For my own good.
I see.
You see?
Yeah. I see.
So, yeah, they took away my rights for my own good. And I was abused for my own good in a positive way. You see, it really made me stronger. And then it really kept me away from a lot of things. And then we are focused. All the time we are focused on certain things. For example, like, all the time you're trying to compete in class, you know, like, I don't know, there are simple things when you begin to get to puberty, there's competition. And girls used to like the boys who do better, not sports, you know. So I don't know really how somebody can be able for to devise a system that can really incorporate those things. Because, like,
Well, you know what happened, and I understand now what you were saying. So you take away something that you you valued, or at least you thought you valued or had great value for you, but something else even more valuable came in its place. And I think and we also practice that in the generation that I grew up in. With our young people today, we as parents, we can take away the social media contact that they have. And if we do that, only if we are diligent and we are persistent as parents, we will give them something even greater. We will give them the ability to be empowered. When young people feel empowered that they can help the family, when they are part of the mechanism of that helps the family to survive, they become empowered. And that becomes more important to them than a lot of the mass media, the technology, and a lot of the contact that they have with their peers. So this is where we have to come back to. Because we need the young people.
Yes.
If we don't train them now to take control of the lives of the families and of the community by doing those or achieving those skills that's required for survival, because we're going into a new lifestyle, a new world, we have to start with our young people. And this we are not doing. We're not doing it because we are not doing it as adults for the family. We are not giving this the correct attention. So hopefully that answered some of your question. So,
our mics are open. We welcome your comments.
I know that there are many people out there who are not prepared for a disaster. But every Wednesday night, hopefully, I will resound the same thing. We must get prepared. When the course, preparedness course is offered again, the next round, we would like for you all to sign up to take the course. It hardly costs you anything, $40 to educate your entire family in preparedness. You spend more than that at McDonald's. We've got to do these things, folks. We've got to be responsible. And we have got to save ourselves. This is not a black and white issue. because the same storm that ends up on the doorstep of my Caucasian neighbor or the Caucasian two blocks away will end up on my doorstep as well. So this is not a black-white issue. But there are other issues. We know redlining and gentrification and all of those other issues that cause inequality and put us in certain neighborhoods, those are racial issues. But the storm coming our way is not a racial issue. How we deal with it when it does come is an individual family issue. Recovery is going to be a racial issue because it is. There are some communities that the federal agencies get in there faster than in other communities. That's going to be an issue. But preparedness helps mitigate. Mitigate means lessen. It helps mitigate the impact of the disaster. And you have already set in place some things to bounce back. That's resilience. If you don't, if you're not a resilient family that has prepared, it's highly unlikely that you'll be able to bounce back. So you must do it.
Okay, Sister Aisha, with that said, I am going to now change the subject, and I want to wish all of our sisters, all of I can say myself, I just celebrated my anniversary during this Valentine's Day. Aziz, I want to thank you and your wife for showing us such hospitality. And I want to end by playing a song that for all of our sisters and married couples. And until next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.
Thank yes, you. Ma'am.
Wa alaykum as-salam. Have a good evening, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.